Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Condensed Histories. What we do on this podcast is we take a piece of pop culture. It might be a movie, a TV show, it might be music, it might be a game of some description. And we reveal how either accidentally or deliberately, just under the surface, there's real history that we can learn things from. I was particularly proud of the time when I managed to do half an hour on a 3 minute ABBA song. And actually, pretty much everything you've heard so far is stuff that I really like. It might be Last of the Mohicans or His Dark Materials or ABBA. And you can see there's a lot of variety there. But do you know what? Don't love everything, because nobody loves everything. And sometimes things that are very popular are things that some people don't like, and that's fine. But in a way, sometimes poking at things a little bit, deconstructing them a little bit, can be fun. So this time round, I'm going to talk to you about the movie Love Actually. And Love Actually, I think for people of a certain age, holds a special place in their heart. It was a huge hit when it first came out in 2003. I know, we're approaching 20 years since this film came out. And it's not without its problems. Even at the time when I was watching it, I wasn't sitting there thinking, this is amazing. But it's built up quite the head of steam. Sometimes people sort of make it to be, and it is obviously set around Christmas. I mean, it specifically has sort of freeze frames sort of flashing up 5 weeks till Christmas, 4 weeks to Christmas, etc., etc. So those things are there, but you could watch it any time of the year, because I'm going to say this, I'm going to give it credit where credit's due. The opening scene and the very last scene actually have almost nothing to do with the movie. There's this voiceover at the beginning by Hugh Grant, and he talks about how if you want to see love, just go to the arrivals lounge of an airport.
Whenever I get gloomy with the state of the world, I think about the arrivals gate at Heathrow Airport.
Now, this is all set in Britain, specifically London, so he's talking about Heathrow, which is a very big airport in London. But it would be true almost anywhere in the world. And they have footage of clearly real people. These aren't actors. I don't know. I presume they must have had sort of like sign off saying, can we use this images of you? But just seeing these people just hugging each other and kissing each other is just a wonderful, warm experience. It could be, you know, little kids going up to their grandparents. It could be partners hugging each other. It could be father, son, whatever. The point is, there is just this joy of seeing loved ones that you haven't seen, even for like a week or so. So that's wonderful. And indeed, the very last shots as the credits start rolling is you see that all again. And parts of the movie are set around Heathrow Airport as well. So anyway, the point is, those are lovely, those are warm, and there is a very good point saying, look, you know, in the world today, we talk about fear, and what's interesting, 2003, we're on the edges of the internet. The internet, certainly by 2003, email by 2003, is a thing. Whether or not we're at the point of social media, we can argue that. I believe that Facebook came out in 2004, for example. So it isn't quite the internet that we know it today, but certainly the point about how there's a lot of anger and frustration out there. And this is one of the problems of the modern world. It's brought us closer together, but it's also led to faster divisions and disinformation and people getting furious at each other across the world over a point of view. So yeah, I mean, those things I think are valid. And look, any movie that's going to explore different forms of love, like a long-term marriage that's kind of become a bit stale, or first love, or unrequited love, or familial love, that's not a bad thing. The other thing that's worth pointing out, that this is written and directed by Richard Curtis, who is a comedy icon in Britain. He was involved in Blackadder.
Blackadder started talking to yourself, I assume.
Yes, it's the only way I can be sure of intelligent conversation.
Upstart Crow, and he's the man behind Four Weddings and a Funeral, which brought the world sort of Hugh Grant in all his glory, in all his foppish, upper middle class, floppy haired glory, and Notting Hill as well. And if you like, that's the first problem. Because Love Actually, even while I was watching it for the first time in the cinema, I was sitting there thinking, this is his greatest hits. And a greatest hits album, while it might be initially pleasing because it's got all the tunes that you like on it, quite often, at least in the olden days, people built albums to sort of tell a story or to have a certain tone. And if you just yank three songs out of that album and slap them with the three songs from the next album, and so in the end you got like 9, 12 great cracking tunes, but they're almost taken out of context. It's not quite the same thing as listening to the original album that they were living in. And same here, this is a hodgepodge of loosely interwoven people. There are people who are conveniently each other's brothers and sisters, or, oh, we go to the same school and that's how we know each other. These people are loosely built together. And another thing, credit where credit's due, a lot of these little stories about love, you know, have a good beginning, middle and end. And if you're fitting together six or seven of these sort of types of stories, these are, you know, it's quite a skill to be able to pack into 2 hours. But at the same time, because there isn't a specific hero or heroine, it's a little harder to sort of root for them. And clearly some of them are better than others. Then we have the problem of movies as a whole portraying love and romance. Because what's in a movie quite often is seen as sort of earnest and, oh, look at them still trying to win the person's hand and make them swoon. In an actual real setting, we'd call them a stalker or obsessive behavior, sort of dangerous tendencies. Take, for example, the story of Colin in this film, which is easily the worst one. Colin is basically works in the post room of this building, of a number of other characters work in the same organization. And he's going around and he's sort of a young man in his 20s, and all the young women, he's sort of going, hi, how are you doing? Will you be my wife? And all this kind of stuff. And it's meant to be cheeky and funny. Or today we would say that that's inappropriate behavior. He would be up in front of HR. You know, there's the Me Too movement. A woman has a right to just sit there and work without being harassed because she happens to be a young, attractive woman. You know, and that's not what she's doing at that moment in time. She's actually copywriting or whatever. So Colin is what we would term now a sex pest. Why do we want Colin to win? I don't know. And Colin's entire story is he can get nowhere with British women, so he decides completely arbitrarily that his British accent will definitely get him a girl in America. And so he decides to throw everything away and go to America. Okay, fine. And he goes to America. He goes to Milwaukee, which is quite funny. And he arrives in a bar, which is clearly made by a British set designer, presumably in Britain, because in the background, there are just random sports pennants. None of them are from Milwaukee. So it's just like, this looks American. Quick, stick this up in a bar. And they have three very attractive young female American actresses who meet him in the bar. And all three of them are ask him to go back to their place. Oh, and there's a fourth one. She's the really hot one, apparently, turning up too. So Colin has a terrible plan, and it works out better than anybody would ever expect it to immediately. There is no character development, and Colin does not deserve this happiness. Also, this is not a thing. You know, there are more subtle stories in this, but this was almost written by a fever dream of a 15-year-old. It makes no realistic sense. Wait, all of it is, of course, fantastical, but this is the bit that's particularly weird. The other one is the Martin Freeman bit, which is quite often taken out in other scenes because this is the bit that really makes it 15-rated. My wife tried showing it to the kids and I went, I don't think this is a good idea. It's rated 15. I seem to remember there's some nudity in this and also there's a lot of bad language in this. But indeed, Martin Freeman and this young lady, I've forgotten her name, she's Stacey in Gavin and Stacey. Apologies to the actress there. The wonderfully smiley, upbeat Welsh lady.
It's Joanna Page.
And anyway, the two of them are completely naked, simulating sex because they're trying to get the lighting of a sex scene, and rather get the actors in, they just need some body doubles so they can get the lighting right. And it's about as graphic as it gets. It's utterly gratuitous. The gag on this one is basically, while the two of them are being fabulously intimate with each other, but obviously for the purposes of a movie, Martin Freeman's trying to pick up the courage to ask her out. And it's sort of like, how can he not do this when all this other stuff's happening? I'm trying to be as vague and ungraphic as possible, but believe me, it's quite graphic in the movie. And turns out that they get together and they even get engaged in the space of 5 weeks. There's a lot of very weird sped up stuff in all movies, not just Love Actually, but in all romance movies. People can meet and 3 weeks later they're proposing. Again, this would be seen as incredibly unhealthy in the real world. It's sort of like, you are really rushing into this. You haven't spent any time together. And yes, we're all well aware that the first few weeks of a relationship are incredibly exciting and incredibly dazzling and overwhelming, and you can barely eat and all that other awful stuff. But that's not a relationship. That's just the beginning bit. Maybe wait a while. I mean, I still remember, I have been together with the lady who is now my wife. We've been together for more than 20 years. We've been married for sort of 15, 16 years. And I still remember our first date and how the two of us were in the Spaghetti House just down the road from Trafalgar Square. And I could barely eat. I was so adrenalized with what was going on. And she was the same. And funnily enough, I'm now more than capable of eating in front of my wife. It's just not a problem 20 years on later. I mean, I would have starved to death if it was still an issue. So yeah, your hormones and chemistry calms down. And in Captain Corelli's Mandolin, there's the beautiful speech by the father to the young couple as they're getting married, which is used in a lot of weddings, or at least was sort of 10, 15 years ago, about how there's a difference between being in love and love, and this sort of fire burns out, but then the embers continue, and the two trees that when you look at them once they've been together for many years, you realize their roots are intertwined. And it's a beautiful, I'm not doing it justice at all.
When you fall in love, it is a temporary madness. It erupts like an earthquake and then it subsides. And when it subsides, you have to make a decision. You have to work out whether your roots have become so entwined together that it is inconceivable that you should ever part. Because this is what love is.
That's the reality. But of course, you've got 2 hours to tell the story. So of course, they're going to meet, have some problems, fall in love, and have a happily ever after in a film. The problem with this one is there are about 6 or 7 happy ever afters. So a little bit more on the moaning, and this is where I'm going to start edging towards some history stuff, because believe me, there is history in this, is the fact that you've also got this weird thing with this writer, and he's going to France and he's got to write his new book, and the woman who's going to be looking after him, she's Portuguese. Now, he can barely speak any, well, he can speak perfect English, but he can barely speak any French, but he can't speak any Portuguese. She can't speak any French. And it, you know, hilarity ensues, and he kind of falls in love with her. Again, this is another problematic one. The two of them have no language in common. She's basically being his cleaner. He's sitting there writing away, and it's like, that's not the start of a healthy relationship. Now, later on, she learns English, and you can see him hilariously working out how to learn Portuguese, and yes, okay, so fine, they're both putting some effort in, but you have no idea if you've got much in common. They don't even sort of kiss, really, until he goes back and declares himself. And he's going to, you know, literally the first conversation they have in a mutual language, he is declaring that he wants to get married to her, which is insane. It's not healthy, okay? But the one bit that I thought this is just the laziest writing ever of Richard Curtis is he's sitting there typing out his new book. Again, this is 2003. By then, people had laptops. Also, it seems to me a lot of writers like to write about writers being left alone in a cottage somewhere or in a suite in a hotel. You ask any modern writer. I mean, look, maybe that's the way Ernest Hemingway wrote, okay? But that's gone the way of the 1930s. Nowadays, people sit in a coffee shop on their laptop or, during the pandemic, at home on a laptop. A laptop's great. You can edit it straight away. You never would use a typewriter nowadays. And also with a laptop, you can email bits. It's much easier to edit. You can obviously check on the internet certain facts you might want to double check when you're writing stuff. I'm saying this as a guy who's written more than 12 books, okay? So yeah, there's just no way. But for hilarity purposes, he's sitting by the edge of a lake, typing this stuff out. She walks over, picks up the rock that's got about 50 pages on it, blows it, the wind blows it into the water. And then, like I say, this really lazy comedy scene where she says something in Portuguese he can't understand, and then he hilariously says in English either the same thing or the contrary thing. Like, for example, he says in English, "Oh, I hope there aren't any eels in here," and she says, "Stop splashing around, you will wake up all the eels." Ha 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 ha. And also she's splashing around trying to pick up all these pages because she realizes, you know, it's her mistake. And she's sort of saying, "I hope this is worth it." And he turns around and goes, "No, there's no need to do it. It's not exactly Shakespeare." This joke is played 5 or 6 times in the space of 2 minutes, if that. And it's like, it's the same gag over and over again. It was okay the first time. After a while, it's like, did you not have anything else to say in this scene? So yeah, look, is Richard Curtis a more famous, successful writer than me? Absolutely. But you've got to take a cold, hard look at his very impressive list of achievements as both a writer and director. And I'm sorry, Love Actually is not his shining star, although it is certainly one of his most successful movies. So that writer, who's played by Colin Firth, by the way, so you've got maximum posh wibbly wobbliness and sort of getting difficulty to say things, a bit like what I'm doing right now with both Hugh Grant and Colin Firth. This is maximum randomness and fluff and fumbling of words between the two of them, sort of posh and awkward between the two of them. Hugh Grant, by the way, just very briefly, he's the Prime Minister. I'll come back to him in a minute. So you've got Colin Firth, and he's clearly in France. They make a very big point about he's in France, but this woman is Portuguese. And as I said, later on, he goes back to her, and everybody around him is Portuguese. And it's very clear. They make a point of showing you that he's arrived in Marseille Airport. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Marseille is part of France. Why is everybody speaking Portuguese? Why is her family all Portuguese? Well, actually, there's a reason for it. And this is where I can bring in a bit of history for you. Because it turns out Marseille does have a very large Portuguese community. How did the Portuguese end up in Marseille? And the answer is, surprisingly, to do with the World Wars. During World War I, to cut a very long bloody story short, the German expansion, the German capturing of France, happened pretty much on the edges of France. There was a tiny sliver of Belgium that was still being fought over, where the trench network went over. And then the vast majority of the trench network went across the very easterly part of France. Not much of France was actually captured, but undeniably part of France was captured. So it wasn't like a lot of this fighting was happening in France/Germany.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So France needed us all the help it could get to try and stop this incredibly bloody carnage. France was virtually bled dry of its own fighting men. And so it was very important that Britain was involved there too. And it was also important to take the pressure off the Western Front by having these titanic clashes in the East, where Germany and Austro-Hungary were invading the Russian Empire. That's the overall view. France needed men. They needed men in the trenches. Now, Portugal is not a hugely populous country, but they sent over 80,000 fighting men to France in World War I, and they fought hard. And this was remembered by France, so that after World War II, in the early 1950s, France again had been somewhat devastated and perhaps had a little bit of a problem with population. French men had died in the war, so Portuguese people came back again. And their contribution to France in the 20th century led to various, like, Portuguese generals and references to Portugal turning up in certain street names, even in places like Paris. And it just so happened that Marseille is a major southerly city in France and isn't a million miles away, or let's say it's a lot closer to Portugal than Paris is. So a lot of Portuguese ended up staying there to help in the rebuilding of France after World War II, but also their fathers might well have been fighting for France a generation earlier. So because of that, you've got this weird disconnect. And if you look at London, you've got Chinatown and things like that, and there are lots of little communities. So actually what they're showing in Love Actually is a real thing, but it's never explained, so that I've checked this online. There's a lot of internet articles and questions going, why is everybody speaking Portuguese when it's clearly France? And the fact that they make no chance to ever reference that is a problem. So, I said I'd mention the Prime Minister. Let's move on to him then, shall we? The year is 2003 when this is coming out, and it is very much a rebuttal to Tony Blair.
Education, education, and education.
Because the other thing that this obliquely references is the war on terror. There was a heavy criticism of Tony Blair. Look, let's perhaps go back. I don't know how much you guys know about Tony Blair one way or the other, but the Tory party, the Conservatives, were in power from 1979 to 1997. Nearly 20 years. A whole generation, like me, grew up not really knowing anything other than a Conservative government. Michael Foote was the leader of the Labour Party, and he just didn't catch the imagination. He was basically that generation's version of Jeremy Corbyn. Now, these people had good ideas. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn has a bad bone in his body, but you don't win elections by purely appealing to the party faithful. Anybody who needs to win an election in the democracy has to reach more than 50%, and no party has 50% of the population. So the problem with Jeremy Corbyn, the problem with Michael Foote and other Labour leaders is they did a good job of keeping the Labour Party happy, but the, if you like, the middle didn't trust them, just thought they were too radical, and things were going all right under a Conservative government. And again, kind of doesn't matter what government we're talking about, but if the economy's doing okay, if people feel safe and secure, they invariably vote for the incumbent rather than the next person, because it's risky. Don't know what's going to happen. So there you go, a little bit of democratic politicking there for you. So Tony Blair spent years trying to make the Labour Party electable. He even for a time referred to it as New Labour. It's not Old Labour, which is a bit scary and linked to the unions. He spent a lot of time courting the mass media so that you'd get favourable articles about them in traditionally conservative newspapers. And in 1997, Tony Blair won by a landslide. It was an obliteration of the Conservative Party, and John Major at that time was the Prime Minister. So Tony Blair came in with a mandate, and within a couple of months of his election victory, Princess Diana had died in that car crash in France. And the royal family did a terrible job of sort of explaining it and grieving with the nation. They were following very traditional royal protocols, which wasn't what the country wanted to see. And I encourage you to have a look at it online. But Tony Blair's speech, there's no way he could have prepared for the event of Diana's death. That was not something that anybody was expecting. But his speech, basically in a car park next to a church with a bunch of microphones duct taped together, is one of the great political speeches of the late 20th century. In the sense that there's no politics there, he does a great job of saying everything that Britain needed to hear. And Tony Blair was so popular at the beginning. But then on September the 11th, 2001, there was the terrorist attacks in America. And within months after that, there was a massive NATO force, including France, Canada, America, obviously, and Britain in Afghanistan. This made sense because clearly the man behind it all, Osama bin Laden, was in Afghanistan. He was supported by this incredibly radical, violent Islamic fundamentals called the Taliban. So it made sense to go there and attack. When you've just had a devastation in your country, the similar levels of Pearl Harbor, it's not just going to be brushed off like, well, that's not very nice. Action had to be taken. And I think a lot of people forget that the invasion of Afghanistan, people were uneasy about, but people got understood. But then in 2003, the year this film was being made, we then have the war in Iraq. And there were all these lies from the George W. Bush government in America about how Saddam Hussein was going to have chemical weapons ready to go in 24 hours, that kind of thing. And there was this hunt for these weapons of mass destruction after the victories in Iraq, and it turned out he didn't have any. And it also turned out that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden, which makes complete sense if you look into the story and politics behind it all. So the whole thing was a lie. And the big mistake that Tony Blair made is, while he'd done a great job of understanding Britain's consciousness and what, you know, how Britain felt, you know, with that Diana speech, and on many occasions early on, in 2003, he basically went to war because America asked him to, and was now fighting in Iraq. And huge crowds were in the streets of Britain. I remember the banner saying, "Make tea, not war," which I particularly like, very British. Suddenly there are hundreds of thousands of people protesting this move. What's this got to do? Because Hugh Grant goes out of his way, there is specific scenes with the American president where Britain's just not going to do it your way anymore. Or there are two references to the fact, like, well, you'll find we're very different to the previous guy.
We got what we came for. And our special relationship is still very special.
Prime Minister?
I love that word, relationship. Covers all manner of sins, doesn't it? I fear that this has become a bad relationship. A relationship based on the president taking exactly what he wants and casually ignoring all those things that really matter to Britain.
Now, this is still during Blair's premiership as Prime Minister of Great Britain. So, you know, it is sort of cocking a snoot. And Hugh Grant at that time perhaps was a little bit like Tony Blair? You know, they're both sort of posh white guys with nice hair. There were echoes between the two of them. So what's interesting is that that really fed to the feeling of the nation in 2003. So you've got this element that's very much in its own time capsule. Because now, if you're a 15-year-old, because really you shouldn't be watching it any younger, if you're a 15-year-old watching it, you're probably not getting that at all. You might understand that Britain and America always have a bit of tensions, but you're not quite sure everyone's going on and on about it. So that's something very much of its time. Then you've got the Portuguese stuff, which is sort of referring back to earlier 20th century. And of course, there's the element of love, which we can all agree is something that goes throughout time. There is Shakespearean poetry from 500 years ago that is resonant today as it was then, because love is love. One of the reasons why lesbians are referred to as lesbians is because the Isle of Lesbos, there was sapphic poetry. From Sapphos, she was a poet. Now, interestingly, she seemed to have loved both men and women, but a lot of her poetry was about how much she loved women. So because of that, that's how you get the connection to lesbian. So Lesbos, the Isle of Lesbos. That writing is more than 2,000 years old. It shows you that love knows no boundaries. It isn't about a time or a place or a sex or a gender or anything like that. There is this fundamental human connection. It is important. And like I say, there is a difference between reproduction, and people love facts like, oh, you know, when swans mate, they mate for life, and humans don't always do that. True, that is true. But the point is, there is this support network that is needed. And I do like the biological argument for it, because if you're just getting down to the basic biology of human reproduction, a man can go around and have literally thousands of children in their lifetime. If they impregnate hundreds of women, they could really spread their seed all over the place. Their DNA is insured for the next generation and then some. Women, however, can't do that. Kind of the maximum amount of children they could probably have in a lifetime is maybe 15, if you're pushing things, okay? So with that in mind, there is a very different emphasis between males and females in terms of the importance of children. I'm talking about this purely from a biological point of view. So what's to stop the guy from impregnating the female and then just running off? And so so what biologists are saying is that's why we have this necessary feeling of love. Because once I've got that connection to that other person, I'm not going anywhere. And human children are rubbish. If you look at a newborn deer or a newborn calf, they can stand within minutes of being born. It takes a human a year. Another fun fact is children tend to start talking and walking round about a year. But because those two things take up so much of brain power from a little child, that they'll do one or the other. They won't start walking and talking at one. They might start a little bit earlier with one or the other. Might be 11 months. Well done, little Sammy or whatever. So yeah, well done them. And the reason for that is because we're not quadrupeds, we're bipeds. The female pelvis is therefore smaller and narrower, and therefore the human head, when it's coming out of the female, is the largest part. And that is actually the part which undergoes amazing development. If you look at the brain of a newborn baby, it's smooth. Where do you get all those kind of wrinkles? That's your evolution of your brain, the continuing improvement of your intellect as you age up, basically. And it even starts rewiring in the teenage years because of all the hormones, hence why you get all the screaming and shouting, which is part of my household at the moment. So the idea of love is not unique to humans, to Homo sapiens, but these sort of life bond things, when they happen, they tend to happen in groups of animals where there's a lot of energy invested in the young. Yeah, by contrast, octopuses, the female will give birth to all these eggs, tend to the eggs until they start hatching, and because she's constantly tending those eggs, she basically dies of malnourishment when the babies are hatched. So you only ever get one spawning from one female octopus. Not the same in the case of, let's say, chimpanzees or indeed humans. So, if you like, the animal world has come up with all these different ways to create the next generation, and love is absolutely part of that. I just think that's a lovely thing to end on, because in the words of the Beatles, all you need is love. Love, actually, however, is probably not all you need. Now, I'm going to give you one last fact, one little nugget in a moment. I just want to say before I do that, don't forget, please click subscribe if you haven't done that already. Please give us a review if you can. This all helps to spread the word. And what I keep saying is, if you like these are really unusual podcasts. A lot of people are not doing it this way. You get history podcasts, you get pop culture podcasts, you get interviews and so on and so forth. I'm the person who sort of smashes this all together. So if you like this, please just tell one other person or post it on your social media, a connection to it on Spotify or Podomatic or Apple Podcast or whatever, wherever you're getting your podcast, please spread the word, help this channel grow. I would really appreciate it. The final fact is, this kind of ends a trilogy of Hugh Grant, Richard Curtis associations, starting off with, you've got Four Weddings and a Funeral, then you've got Notting Hill, and then you've got this one. And he plays virtually the same character in all three of them, except what they do for a job. This is one of the joys of Bridget Jones's Diary, where finally he plays somebody a bit naughty, a bit more grit to him, rather than just this foppishness that you get in these three. But anyway, what I wanted to tell you, the last little fact is, as I said, there are these three movies. Notting Hill is the middle one. I really like that one. Perhaps Four Weddings is the biggest classic there. Notting Hill actually has a place close to my heart, because my parents used to have a delicatessen on Portobello Market. And I actually got to meet Richard Curtis. When I was working there at the delicatessen, at the front of it, there was an egg stall. So throughout my childhood and teenage years, I was on that egg stall in like summer holidays and sometimes helping out on Saturdays and half terms and things like that. And I got to meet, well, the drummer of Transvision Vamp lived just round the corner. Angela Rippon was somebody I managed to serve on multiple occasions. Patsy Kensit used to live round there at a time when I really had a crush on Patsy Kensit, so that was very awkward as a teenage boy because I'd just seen her in Lethal Weapon 2. And all this stuff's going on. So Notting Hill, when if you watch the film, this idea of this of really cosmopolitan place, this weird mixture of the super rich artists and the very, very poor sort of council estates and immigrant community. It was genuinely like that. However, what Notting Hill demonstrates is it was this marvelous mixing pot of the sort of bohemian and just the immigrant experience. It's around that area you get the Notting Hill Carnival, for example, the largest carnival in the world, except for Rio. So yeah, it's amazing. And I always love that place, but it's a place of its time, because as house prices grew up, and also not helped by Notting Hill making it even cooler, All the properties are basically now, there was a balance of about 50-50 between poor and wealthy when I was a kid there. Nowadays, it's all wealthy. That Notting Hill experience just doesn't exist anymore. So again, it's kind of a time capsule of an experience in London that just doesn't exist anymore. And the last thing I'm going to say is, the other thing that makes me smile is, my parents' shop is in one of the opening shots of that film, and a lot of the street traders I used to talk to, I know the names of Charlie Collins, for example, and some of these other people, all now long retired, because that kind of fruit and veg element doesn't exist anymore. Absolutely love that film, and I encourage you to check that one out over Love Actually.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.